Hey, before we get to the show, I wanted to remind you to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders. If you haven't signed up yet, sign up now to get ad-free episodes, twice monthly bonus episodes, and a whole bunch of other cool stuff at patreon.com/curbsiders. Paul, my first job was working in an orange juice factory, but I got canned.
Oof.
Couldn't concentrate.
Okay, all right, okay. If you would have stopped and gotten canned, I would have said it should have been like a soda factory or something, but all right. Great stuff.
Thanks, Paul. I thought squeeze would be in there for sure.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and its affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend, and America's primary care physician, at least that's what his mom stencils in his underwear, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hey, Paul.
Hey, I like that you finally revised it after I gave you a hard time for saying she tattoos it in my underwear, which doesn't make any real sense.
It doesn't make any sense. Well, Paul, your mom's a lovely woman, and I'm always glad to mention her on the show.
So she says hi, by the way.
On tonight's show, this is a geriatric-focused episode with our friends from the Penn Geriatric Medicine, featuring two great guests. Our guests are Dr. Allison Mishner and physical therapist Suzanne Zukoski, helping us through this condition. But Paul, before we tell them more about our guests, how about you remind them, what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
Sure, Matt. As always, we are the internal medicine podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. I'll tell you about both our guests, Matt, if you're okay with me doing so. So we had a great conversation with our guests, Dr. Allison Mishner and Suzanne Zukoski, as you mentioned. So Dr. Mishner is a geriatrician and the medical educator at the University of Pennsylvania, where she serves as the program director for the Geriatrics Fellowship and oversees geriatrics curricula at the Perelman School of Medicine. Clinically, she splits her time between home-based primary care and inpatient geriatrics unit, but she also previously was the medical director of the subacute rehab. She is passionate about mobility, falls prevention, and helping patients stay on their feet, literally, to maximize independence and quality of life. Suzanne Zukoski, our other guest, has a master's degree in physical therapy and gerontology. She has been working in geriatric care for 25 years across the healthcare spectrum. She's worked in acute care hospitals, rehabs, long-term care facilities, home health, and hospice. So, Matt, this episode, we applied the 5Ms framework to the geriatric syndrome of falls. So we learned about what the initial assessment might look like, how to do a really sort of focused physical examination to kind of gauge how to best help the patients. We also got some really neat sort of inside baseball about what physical therapy, how they think about patients, how they set them up for success, and how they work within the multidisciplinary team. So without further ado, let's get to it.
A reminder that this and most episodes will be available for CME credit for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All right. Well, it is a pleasure to be recording with both of you. And our standard first question, the audience always wants to know, because they want to get to know you a little bit before we get all this wisdom from you, a hobby or interest that you have outside of medicine. So Allison, we'll start with you.
Yeah, if you had asked me this a year ago, I would have told you I like to travel. I had just gotten back from the Paris Olympics, but I'm a new mom to a 7-month-old, so my life looks a little bit different. So that's taken up all my hobbies, but it's been fun. It's been really fun.
If you travel with a 7-month-old, you're basically putting on a show for like however long the flight is. Well, that Paul, you're going to Paris or France at some point in the near
future.
That's the plan. As well.
Yeah, I keep saying it out loud to hold myself accountable. I should probably get a ticket like tomorrow.
That's exciting.
Suzanne, how about you? What's a hobby or interest that you have outside of your job in medicine?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm really looking forward to the start of the orchestra season here in Philadelphia. We have a world-class orchestra. And it's just one of my favorite things to do, to go and sit in a room with 1,000 people and be quiet and listen to world-class musicians just perform at, you know, the peak of their talent. It's really special.
Are you a musician yourself? Is that why you enjoy it so much? Like, I don't know how much I would get out of it going to that. I'd just be like, oh yeah, it's pretty good. Sounds pretty good. The instruments are in tune. They're not playing the wrong notes.
To be honest, you can blame my father for this. He got me interested in expensive hobbies when I was young. So I enjoy the classical music, opera, ballet, Broadway musicals, all of that kind of stuff.
Okay. That's good. So classy. Yeah. Paul, we could use some class on this show.
I was a French horn player in high school. I don't know who you're talking to.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And I will say just a side note about watching orchestras perform on stage. What they don't talk about is the fact that you have to out what's called a spit valve about halfway through performance, because all the playing through, like, there's actually saliva accumulates, and the brass instruments have special valves and tubes that they kind of pull out and dump their saliva out on the stage floor. It's fairly gnarly for the production of beautiful art.
That's good, Paul. I like that. That's a good fact to transition us to our case from Cashlack Memorial, because we have a lot of content to get to here.
All right. Well, we will start with a case. This is an all-timer name that we're doing for this episode. So we're going to tell you about Faye L. Down, who is an 82-year-old woman with a past history of type 2 diabetes, complicated by neuropathy and retinopathy. Ms. Down has a history of osteoarthritis, status post-rectal knee replacement in 2021, high blood pressure, atrial fibrillation on apixaban, anxiety, and mild dementia, who presents to the hospital after a fall at home. So Faye says that she was in her kitchen heating up some frozen dinners for herself and her son, and the next thing that she knew, that her feet went out from underneath her and she was sitting on her bottom on the floor. She doesn't think that she lost consciousness. She doesn't think she hit her head, but she can't really recall what happened around the time of the fall. Her son was upstairs and heard a thump, came downstairs and found her sitting on the floor. She was able to get up with assistance, but they had been told by the cardiologist to be evaluated after any fall, given her active anticoagulation. So her son called 911 and off to the hospital they went. Faye's adult son lives with her in her two-story Philadelphia row home and provides informal care, but he works outside the home during the day. When he moved in with her last year, he noticed some cognitive changes and took her to the PCP, who diagnosed her with mild dementia. He was worried about her safety with complex tasks, so he's taken over some of her IADLs, but she continues to help with the cooking. Her son has borrowed a rollator from her neighbor, but she only uses it when walking long distances outside. So that was a lot of backstory for young Ms. Down. And we'll start with Allison. I think just very, very broadly, and then we'll start to narrow things down. Can you just tell us how to define a fall? It seems like it should be something basic, but I'm sure there are some technical definitions we should be aware of.
No, it's actually very, very basic. All a fall is coming to rest unintentionally at a lower surface, the ground or the floor.
Do you find this is miscategorized often by people? I mean, I think most people, I'm definitely been guilty of this, just write mechanical fall, or if we think someone passed out, we might write syncope. So is there some preferred terminology that you would like people to use? This is your chance to, get people to get this right.
Yeah. So I really, really think we should shy away from the term mechanical. I don't know where that came from. And it's kind of become like this thing I see in charts and in diagnoses. And I don't really know what it means. And I think it's kind of used as like, I think different people use it differently. And I think different people have different meanings. I think when some people use the term mechanical, they use it to mean a fall that did not involve syncope. But that's not always the case. And a fall is a fall, and a fall deserves workup regardless of whether there was syncope or not. So I think my other issue with the term mechanical is when people use it, they kind of feel like they've found the diagnosis and they're done. So I really take a lot of problem with that term, and my residents know never to use it when I'm on service. If you asked about if there's like other types of falls, I mean, there's other words we sometimes use for falls, like slips or trips. All these things can maybe be a little bit more helpful in that they kind of get at a mechanism, which might affect kind of the way that you think about a differential diagnosis. But at the end of the day, a fall is a fall.
Paul, don't you always just find it funny to see like what sets off people, like certain just like attendings? Like I was talking to my residents. I was like, you should be proud of yourselves for graduating. Like this, you have a hard job. Like we as attendings are just these like people that like you can set us off by just using the like mechanical fall instead of just saying plain fall. We had one attending told us that if someone suggests ordering a pneumonia, he hisses at them like a cat. So it's just like, you know, I love it. And it's one of the few joys we have as an attending is to really just like, they have no idea what it could be that could set us off. For me, it's like ordering a PRN blood pressure medicine overnight. You know, that can really, that gets on my nerves. Paul, what about you?
Oh, everything gets on my nerves. That's why I don't like to work with me.
Okay. You looked like you were going to go launch into something else.
No, I was just going to say the next attending, I guarantee, like orders a pan, like a pneumonia on every single patient. Like that is the curse of residency. It's not just that people are different. It's that they are complete opposites every single time.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel for all you trainees out there listening to this. Okay. So falls, it can be helpful to describe it as a slip or a trip, right? Because that might imply some sort of mechanism, but we can say just fall in general. It needs a workup, even if we think it was not because of syncope. Any other categories, any other buckets you're putting it into? Like, so you have fall, you have syncope, anything else that we should, have here in our history taking?
I mean, not really. When you have, there is a lot in the history. In the history taking, yes, there's a lot that we need to get into, and we can certainly talk about that. Again, a fall is a fall. Syncope could be one cause of a fall, and syncope certainly has a differential diagnosis. A fall has a differential diagnosis. There's some overlap there. And I think even syncope can be very, it's not as black and white as we think, right? Faye, our patient here, doesn't really remember exactly what happened. She has some dementia, maybe can't give a good history. So maybe there was syncope, maybe there wasn't. We don't always know. And then there's a lot of gray area as well, because there's presyncope. So how are we going to classify that? So I think like when you hear syncope or presyncope, it might point you in one direction in terms of a differential. But then again, so does the word fall. So you're going to think about a differential, right, and ask questions based on that.
Yeah, I think it's always a little anxiety provoking. You have somebody who, because they might have memory issues or because they just frankly can't remember, or they're not sure if they lost consciousness or not. And then unless you see some obvious bruising, you're like, did you hit your head? Because you're on this person's on apixaban for AFib. So it's always a little bit of an anxiety provoking thing. And then we gave you some other things in the history here, like she lives with her son. They have a 2-story home. Allison, so I wanted to ask about, we've talked a little bit about the terminology here, and the falls are, and we were kind of getting at that falls are just a challenging thing to work up, and they're called a geriatric syndrome. We've talked about it a little bit on the show before when we talked about weight loss, but can you remind the audience, like, what is a geriatric syndrome? And then we'll kind of go on with the case, but I just remind them of that terminology.
Yeah, I think falls are a great example of a geriatric syndrome. Geriatric syndromes are common health problems or clinical conditions that older adults experience that are multifactorial and could be a result of age-related physiologic changes, other kind of chronic diseases, or even like social or environmental factors. So when you get like a confluence of all these different things, it results in a geriatric syndrome. And we know that falls are very common. About a quarter of older adults fall every year. And we know that there are usually a lot of factors that lead into falls. And this can be very stressful for learners, because it's not like that classic disease or organ-based history that we take. It's usually a lot broader than that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the audience knows we're going to talk about 5Ms, because we've done, this is probably our 4th or 5th episode in geriatrics that we've done where we've sort of highlighted this framework. But before we get to that, Paul, let's read the next part of the case.
Sure. So in the ER, our friend Faye gets a CBC and BMP, which are at her baseline. She has a chest x-ray done, which shows no acute abnormalities. She also went through the donut of truth and got a CT of the head, which showed no acute abnormalities, but she does have evidence of chronic ischemic white matter changes. She is admitted to medicine for further fall workup. She is given acetaminophen for mild pain and transferred to the floor for further management. So you mentioned the 5 M's. So how do we apply this framework to this particular geriatric syndrome?
Yeah, I like that you guys have talked about the 5 M's in a lot of your other recent episodes. The 5 M's are a really good way to dissect geriatric syndromes when you can't use that kind of classic disease or organ-based approach. So if you think about the 5 M's, and hopefully your listeners know by now, they include multimorbidity, medications, mind, mobility, and matters most. These are the kinds of things I would consider when talking to this patient about her fall and getting the history.
Hey, Curbsiders. If you're planning for CME for the end of the year and beyond, check out our friends at Continuing Education Company. They offer ACCMA accredited and ABIM mock approved CME with a strong focus on primary care and hospital medicine. CEC hosts 20 live conferences each year in top destinations, including Florida Keys and the Big Island of Hawaii this fall and Naples, Florida and Maui this winter. All conferences feature half-day sessions, so your afternoons are free to relax or explore. And for hospitalists, don't miss the 9th annual Hospitalist Conference in Clearwater Beach, Florida's number one beach, coming up December 1st to 4th. Speakers include Curbsider's own Rahul Ganatra plus Tony Brew with his popular talk, Things We Do For No Reason. Two goats, if I must say so. If you can't make it in person, all events are available via live stream with on-demand replays if you need flexibility. Plus, explore CEC's vast library of online CME with over 500 hours of on-demand courses across primary care and hospital medicine. Use the promo code CURB30 to get 30% off all online courses and webcasts just for Curbsiders listeners. Visit cmemeeting.org/curbsiders to learn more. That's cmemeeting.org/curbsiders and use the promo code CURB30. This episode is brought to you by DocsGPT by Doximity. It's a new AI tool that helps you get quick, evidence-based answers right when you need them. And if you already trust Doximity Dialer, then you know that they build high-quality stuff, and I can say from using it myself that DocsGPT is high quality. You can ask it clinical questions, it's going to give you the answers, it's going to cite its sources, and it does all sorts of cool stuff. It's not just answering questions, you can upload PDFs, it's HIPAA compliant, so it can help you analyze labs if you need help with that. I like to ask it about supplements so I can get a good starting point in the literature and I can look through the trials. DocsGPT is really a great option to add to your clinical workflow. Think of it like the ChatGPT for medicine built specifically for clinicians. It's going to give you concise, reference-backed answers to your clinical questions backed by supporting evidence. It's also powerful for drug-related questions, providing clear answers on dosing, contraindications, side effects, and more. DocsGPT's drug information isn't AI-generated. It's drawn directly from structured, peer-reviewed literature and FDA data. And if you're worried about privacy, DocsGPT is private by default, secure, and fully HIPAA-compliant, so you can use it confidently in your clinical workflow. It's fast, intuitive, and built right into the Doximity platform. There's no setup, no subscriptions, no hidden paywalls, just instant answers that fit right into your workflow. So if you haven't tried it yet, check out DocsGPT by Doximity and see how it can simplify your clinical workflow from patient care to paperwork. Visit DocsGPT.com or use the link in the show notes to start using it today. That's DocsGPT.com or use the link in the show notes and start using it. Try it out. I think you're going to like it. Why don't we go through the example of how you might apply it to this? But I like the 5 M's because for these geriatric syndromes, it's always like if you try to work it up the way you're working up, like, okay, they had this thing happen, there must be one thing that caused it, you're going to fail. There's always, you're going to be overwhelmed. So this is a good way to kind of group things into categories. So if you want to go through them, I mean, multimorbidity was the first one you mentioned. You want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. So for multimorbidity, I think about the chronic health conditions that are at play. So for this patient, you mentioned that she has dementia, diabetes, osteoarthritis. I think neuropathy was in there as well. So those are some chronic medical conditions that might pertain to this case. Another thing to always ask about is prior falls. We know that having one fall is the biggest risk factor to predict future falls. So you want to think about that. So if you see someone who's presenting with one geriatric syndrome, there's often other geriatric syndromes as well. Other things to think about with multimorbidity are sensory impairments, such as like visual or auditory impairment. And then when I'm thinking about this category too, broadly, I like to ask patients about whether there have been any other recent changes to health, like even in the last days or weeks preceding the fall.
Yeah. I guess it's part of what's fun about being an internist is that multimorbidity is there. It could also be what's part of like, what was overwhelming or, yeah, overwhelming or can be confusing. But, you know, Paul, you're America's PCP, so that probably doesn't bother you.
No. Well, sure. Yeah. You love the investigation. I will say when we're precepting falls in the clinic, I do feel like the temptation is to lead the witness a little bit and try to lead them in ideology. Like, I think even the way we ask about like head strikes, and you didn't hit your head, right? Like, it's always kind of very leading so that you don't have to find a new diagnosis or have something additional to worry about. So I think it is probably important to take a step back and just make sure you're being subjective and giving yourself the chance to kind of find the underlying ideology and just not make assumptions, because I think there's the multimorbidity is complicated.
I do think medications are, so I think people are pretty good at thinking that medications may be part of what's causing problems in older adults. And one of my favorite geriatricians who I used to work with would always say, like, in a geriatric case, it's always a medication until proven otherwise. That was like his thing, which, you know, I think usually he was right if we were in a morning report. But any specific medications? I know there's the Beers list, but anything that you, any pet peeves here or any like blind spots for the, that you can point out to the audience when it comes to medications and falls?
Yeah, I love that. I always tell my residents to assume that it's the medication first. There's certain high-risk medications that we know have been linked to falls, psychoactive medications, antidepressants, antipsychotics, benzodiazepines, kind of the usual players. A lot of them are on the Beers list, like you mentioned. Opioid pain medications can certainly contribute. Honestly, like any other medication as well, like things like antihypertensive medications, if you're over-treating hypertension, or diabetes medications, if you're over-treating the diabetes. So I like to think about that as well. And then another one that's commonly implicated in falls are like loop diuretics. So those are the ones that classically are linked with falls. But again, I think like if we're targeting a lower blood pressure or lower blood sugars, then it's necessary, like any medication can potentially be risky, just depending on what your treatment targets are.
I feel like I always have to ask specifically about diphenhydramine because it's not on the medication list. It is often taken over the counter. If you come to the doctor enough, you're going to end up on a second generation antihistamine. And the number of patients I have that are taking both, like, well, I'm on loratadine, but then also I take the diphenhydramine for this, this, or this. And you're just like, oh God, like it just, but it's not usually often not on the medication list. And I just have to ask every single time with the number of patients who really, frankly, almost no one should be on it. But the number of patients, older patients who are taking it without any awareness of the hazards is breathtaking sometimes.
Yeah, that's a great point, Paul. I think asking about over-the-counter medications is really helpful too.
And nowadays, I think you have to ask about, you know, any cannabinoids, CBD, THC of any kind. And I've had a couple patients like old guys coming in that were falling or women, but it's usually like the partner's like, he's drinking. And I'm like, oh, okay. How much are you drinking? Like 10-ounce glass of wine, probably not good with all your other medications and your balance is already bad. So I do, just because somebody, even if they have some dementia and they're older, I will ask about those things. And sometimes the partner will like kind of out them for you. So that can
be helpful. Absolutely. I'm a home-based primary care provider when I'm not on service in the hospital. So I get to see patients in their own homes.
Oh, yeah.
So sometimes I take for granted, like in the hospital setting, you have to ask about this kind of stuff. But in the home, often I'm seeing it firsthand. Which really gives a very nice lens to kind of pick up on some of these things in the medicine cabinet or, you know, on the countertop that could be, also be contributing.
Okay. So the other three M's we have to go through are mind, mobility, and matters most. Do you want to, like, any specifics you want to highlight there before we move on to the next part?
Yeah. So for mind, we think of the three D's: dementia, depression, and delirium. So dementia can be a common risk factor for falls, which I often see not getting necessarily overlooked, but people don't necessarily address it because people don't necessarily feel like there's as much that can be done about it. But dementia can cause falls for, you know, a few different pathways, the impaired safety awareness, poor executive function, and then the changes to visual spatial function that can occur with dementia. So definitely a very common risk factor for falls. Depression in and of itself is a risk factor for falls. So that's another one. And then delirium, you know, sometimes, especially in the hospital, if we're seeing a patient with an acute change in mental status leading up to a fall. That's why I really like to ask about any recent changes in health or like an acute illness. I've seen several times someone coming in like the early stages of a URI or a UTI or some sort of infection, and they're presenting with delirium, which led to a fall. But really, when you kind of tease things apart, you find some sort of like underlying infection. So I think the mind piece is really important for a number of reasons. Mm-hmm. Mobility obviously plays into falls. You're asking questions about someone's baseline mobility. You want to know if there's been change in mobility. You want to know about assistive device usage. You want to know about like someone's physical space and how they're getting around, like what they need to do in a day to be mobile. And then going along with that, like the ADLs and IADLs, the functional piece, like Faye was heating up a dinner when she fell. So asking about function and how people are physically performing functions, I think is really important to ask about. And then finally, matters most. This is where you get into the home environment and family supports that someone might have, and asking questions about the home environment. Like, what does your space physically look like? Again, I am lucky that I get to see people's homes, but when I'm in the hospital and asking about this, I really try to get a good picture in my mind of what the person's physical space may look like by asking a lot of questions about what their environment looks like at home.
So, I mean, that's great. And Suzanne, from your perspective, as a physical therapist, when you're seeing people in the hospital, are you asking any additional questions about any of the things we just talked about?
Oh, yes. When I start, I start with interview questions, including their home setup. So how many steps is it to get into the house? And when you're going up into the house, is there a railing on the right or the left side? Once you're in the house, is your bedroom on the first floor or second floor? Is there a railing on the steps to get to the second floor? Faye has a stair glide, so she's actually taken a ride up the steps on her stair glide, which is a sign of, you know, already some mobility problems. She has a walk-in shower with a shower chair, but no grab bars. So, like, I want to kind of find out what's going on in their house as far as the more prominent places to fall, which, you know, steps and the bathroom. When I get to the kitchen, I kind of want to break down what may have happened when she fell. So she was using a rollator outside of the house, but not inside of the house. And was she trying to carry two dinners at the same time, when maybe she could have been using a hand on the counter to move one thing at a time, or putting, you know, holding two hands on one item at a time? Sometimes we tell people to slide the plates close to the table so that you slide it down the counter, and then you only have to go from the closest spot on the counter to the table to kind of cut down on some of that area for falling. Obviously, area rugs are a problem. You know, if she thinks that she tripped, did she trip on an area rug that's right at the base of her sink, by the microwave or whatever else? So I want to find out a little bit more details about what's going on inside the house.
I have to say, I am curious that I have never thought to ask about the laterality of the handrail. Like, it's just not something that would have ever occurred to me. Of course it's important, but like, it's just not once what I've ever thought to ask. That is, yeah, I'm just very angry at myself for 10 years of negligence. Sorry, Matt, I cut you off.
Don't worry about it. People forget about it all the time. Or they don't think about it. And specifically for Faye, it doesn't make much of a difference. She didn't injure her upper extremities. She doesn't have a history of a stroke with severe hemiplegia or anything. But, you know, an upper extremity fracture or hemiplegia, that would be one of the reasons that we're asking about what side the step is on, what side the railing is on.
Well, Paul's a big physical exam lover. I mean, I think everyone should do a physical exam and have respect for it. But Paul likes talking about it more than most people. Suzanne, what are you looking for in your physical exam when you're working with people? You just sort of hinted at some of the history stuff, but what would be important? Like, if we were an internist trying to do a physical exam before you got there, like, what should we be doing that you might do?
Yeah. Let's say we really wanted to impress you, because really that's my goal, is for the next person to read my note and be like, man. So what? Frame it in that way, please.
Paul, I love your goals here. what I'm looking for, because I get into a room and somebody is laying in bed and they haven't been out of bed since they've gotten into the room very often. For somebody like Faye, who is in with a fall, I will start with orthostatics. Whether or not somebody has ordered orthostatics to be done, it's just something that kind of became part of my practice working in geriatrics and with the medically complex older adult. There's so many factors that come into play that we kind of want to make sure that we're looking at everything. So I start with taking their blood pressure while they're lying down, and I'm asking them lots of questions. I ask them to sit on the side of the bed, and I want to see if they can follow the directions, if they have to break down the getting from lying to sitting into maybe rolling and then putting their legs over the side of the bed and then coming up into sitting, or can they do it, you know, without any prompting in between. Once somebody is sitting on the side of the bed, I'm looking at, can they sit at the edge of the bed unsupported? I'll ask them to put their hands in their lap, and if they can sit unsupported with their hands in their lap, I'll have them kick one leg up and hold it up against gravity and then back down, and I'll have them do it with the other leg. And when you have somebody lift their leg up against gravity and hold it, it's both looking at the strength in their leg, obviously, but it's also a balance test too. So if somebody can pick their leg up and kick it up and hold it up there, and they're not taking their arms and grabbing onto the bed or falling over, I mean, I can still check their legs for more thorough strength. And she has a history of neuropathy, so I want to look a little bit into what her sensation situation is, and how I can, you know, make sure that we're using the right footwear or anything that she might have in the room. Mm-hmm. Once I have somebody sitting and they've been sitting for a minute or two, I want to get their blood pressure, see where that is compared to the first one that I've taken. And if it's down a little bit and I'll ask them if they're having any problems. If they're not having any problems, I go from room to room with a walker. I'm ready with my walker with the two front wheels, ready to go. I put it in front of them and I'll ask Miss Faye to stand up and see how that goes. Generally, it would take probably about 25% assistance from me, which is what we would call minimum assistance or minimal assistance, and it's abbreviated with min with a capital A after it. That if you're trying to understand what our notes say.
Yeah. Yeah. So min and maximum assist is what, like, you just have to lift them up off the bed, like they, or you need two people to lift them up off the bed?
Well, we actually break it down into if you need one or two people. Mm-hmm. But essentially, the easiest is just to say, like, a min assist would be about 25% assistance from a therapist. Mod assist is about 50-50. Max assist is about 75 from the therapist and 25 from the patient.
Yeah. So I think sometimes people in the hospital think that, like, it sounds like you're doing a very, like, every piece of your assessment has like a very specific purpose that in things that you're looking for, which is great. Because I think sometimes in medical school, we were just taught to do the whole physical exam at once because you need to know how to do everything. But if you talk to like physical exam experts, they say like, no, I have like a hypothesis driven exam. I'm only doing things like we do other tests. Like you should only do the test if you know what you're going to do with the result of the test. And it sounds like you're being very thorough with that. And I think sometimes when people order physical therapy consults, they think you're just going to come and like work out with the patient, but you're actually doing a lot of diagnostics, it sounds like.
Yes. I think that especially in geriatrics, it's important to look at a lot of different aspects of what's happening with a patient so that we can address the issues at hand. You know, I do a very thorough chart review before going in to see patients. I'm not going in to... I always tell them, well, we're not going to run a marathon. I want to see where you're at today so we can set a baseline and I can talk to the doctors about what's happening today and we can make a plan to set you up for success. You know, and then when I have the patient stand, I'll take the blood pressure yet again. And depending on how they're feeling, I'll decide how far we're going to go. Are we going to just take a few steps to a chair? Are we going to try and walk to the door of the room? Are we going to walk in the hallway? All of those kind of things are, you know, in the moment decisions based on how all of it's going.
So let's talk about any specific tests that you think are most important for someone who has fallen, whether it's like the timed up and go test or just ambulating people. You know, we mentioned some of the balance stuff that you do while they're sitting on the bed. You mentioned the orthostatics, but what about other tests once you're getting them up?
I don't tend to do them necessarily on my first evaluation because there's already so many things that I'm asking a cognitively impaired person to do. And if I start asking them to do complex things in like in the Berg balance test, you know, stand on one foot, tap your feet on a step stool, pick this pen up off of the floor, you know, people get flustered and they get frustrated. And I'm still trying to establish a trust with them so that they'll participate with me. So I end up doing a lot more of what I can see about what they're presenting with that day. If they are very advanced and they don't need a lot of assistance, I'll add in tests to see about how their the fall risk is. I love a 5-time sit to stand if somebody can actually do that. There's a 30-second sit to stand, which is great too. The timed up and go, in theory, to be able to do that, you're not supposed to need an assistive device. So you can do it with an assistive device and write that down, absolutely, but it's not necessarily what I'm looking at on my initial evaluation.
Okay. I think also a lot of these screening tests that Suzanne's talking about are just that, they're screening tests. So those are to identify patients who may be at a higher risk of falling. If you have someone in the hospital that's there for a fall, you already know that they're at the highest risk of falls because they had a major injury or needed medical evaluation. So the screening tests are a little bit less useful in the acute setting. I think they often might get more, they might get used more in the outpatient setting when you're trying to risk stratify patients.
I can do it on a subsequent treatment session if there's questions that specifically somebody has or if there's something that I'm seeing. But Faye has arthritis and she fell. She's going to have aggravated the arthritis in that fall. So she's going to be having back pain, hip pain, knee pain, especially because that knee, the one knee is worse. And the other one that hasn't been replaced is going to be pretty painful. So I'm going to be looking at how she's walking. I want to see how antalgic her gait is. Is she able to fully extend both of her knees when she walks? Is she walking with her knees flexed when she's bearing weight through the legs? Those can be indicators of some range of motion and strength deficits, but it's also a very inefficient way to try to walk around with your knees bent. And I don't want Faye to be wasting her energy by walking around with her knees bent.
Well, let's go back to Faye's case for a minute here. Allison, I wanted to ask you, we had Faye, we said she had this fall. We don't know exactly why she fell. She was in her kitchen preparing a meal. And we know she has multimorbidity. She has some mild dementia. And she's gotten some basic labs, which really didn't show anything. She had a CT of the head, didn't show any bleeding in there, just some chronic white matter changes, which is like kind of a dime a dozen for somebody that age. So what other testing do you recommend, or what other things are you considering before we, move on with things for Faye?
Yeah, I think when you're evaluating someone with falls, it's really important to get that history because the testing is really going to be based on what you're identifying on history and exam. And you're going to target the type of testing based on what you think are potential causes of the fall. So for Faye, you know, we know a little bit about her past medical history. We know she has, I think she has atrial fibrillation. That's why she was on the Eliquis. So it would be reasonable to do an EKG and maybe put her on telemetry to see whether her atrial fibrillation, you know, if she has a rhythm problem or something that's kind of changed with that, that could have contributed to the fall. If she was complaining of any like chest pain or any like prodromal cardiac symptoms, maybe an echo would be helpful, but it's definitely not necessary for every single fall, even in someone that has a significant cardiac history. You know, she has the history of arthritis, so a really good physical exam of that knee, and that's where Suzanne would be helpful, or a physical therapist, to assess the mobility and the details of how she's ambulating. And then we mentioned a history of dementia, or at least looking at her chart to find out what the status of her dementia is. How significant is that? Could that have contributed at all? She also, I think we mentioned she has diabetes. So I would maybe assess her diabetes control with an hemoglobin A1C, maybe some blood sugars in the hospital to get a sense of whether that's over or under control, just because we don't really have good that much history about exactly what happened with the fall. So that's kind of where I'm thinking with Faye. Again, kind of directing my medical workup at her underlying conditions, the 5 M's that I've kind of identified for her, and any potential symptoms that maybe she had.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we have a little bit more of the case here. Paul, if you want to read that. And I think we already talked a little bit about, like, Suzanne had already gotten some of the additional information from the family, but let's go through this other part of the case here.
So Faye is noted to have heart rates in the 50s during her hospital stay, but her orthostatic blood pressures remain negative. On exam, she does have pain with ambulation in her right knee and bruising on her buttocks. She has an EKG, which shows atrial fibrillation, so we cracked the case wide open. She is monitored on telemetry for 48 hours, which shows atrial fibrillation with rates sometimes going into the 50s. Her labs are notable for an hemoglobin A1C of 6.5%, but are otherwise within normal limits. Her medication list includes apixaban, as previously noted, amlodipine, metoprolol, metformin, glipizide, citalopram, and donepezil. And just to recap Faye's home situation, she's in a two-story home with 5 steps to enter, a half bath on the first floor, a full bathroom on the second floor with a walk-in shower with a shower curtain. There are no grab bars, but she does have a shower chair. She uses a Steriglide inside. And prior to her admission, she was able to perform household mobility, but she uses a rollator outside the home. And I think that's probably as much recap as we need for this point now. So does that change anything that you think about, Faye, or would that alter any of the additional workup or sort of guide any further testing or evaluation you would do at this point, Allison?
So I think I kind of mentioned, based on that history, the testing that I would have done. So she is a little bit bradycardic, and we've monitored on telemetry. So I'd say that was helpful. We've looked over her medication list very closely. And so, you know, I'm already kind of thinking about several potential contributors to her fall. And that's sort of what I would document when I'm writing her HPI or her assessment and plan as the etiology of the fall. I would list out some of these risk factors, and then I would take it to the next step of, okay, like, now that I've identified these risk factors, how am I going to address each of them systematically and potentially prevent her from falling again?
So with falls, I mean, I think we're getting to the key part here is, like, what interventions can we offer that actually have strong evidence for them for someone who has started to fall?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. So there's actually 3 main arms of evidence-based fall prevention. The first one is multifactorial risk factor assessment and management, which is really a terrible name. They need better branding. But I think it is just what it sounds like, is looking over all of the patient's potential fall risk factors and then potentially trying to address each of them. So that's kind of the one arm of fall prevention. And we know that that is what we should be doing for our highest risk patients. And our highest risk patients are automatically ones that are in the hospital for a fall or who had a major injury, patients who had one or more falls in the past year, or patients who are unsteady on their feet. So patients in that highest risk category deserve that multifactorial risk factor assessment. So that's another reason why in the hospital I really push my residents to try to identify fall risk factors, because that's what we're going to do to help the patient. And in meta-analyses, we've seen about around a 25% relative risk reduction with those strategies. Of course, it's hard to measure because it's a variety of different interventions. It's not just one thing, unfortunately, but we do know that that can be helpful. The other 2 arms of fall risk prevention or fall prevention that we'll talk about, I'm sure, later on are exercise and home modifications. So those are other areas that we know can be helpful for preventing falls.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. Do you feel like you can never get ahead of charting? Imagine a world where you don't need to think about notes again. Introducing Freed, an AI medical scribe built to free clinicians everywhere. And listen, I can tell you it does this because I've been using this for 2 years. I love it. Having a scribe in the room has been game-changing for me. I don't worry so much. I can focus on what the patient is saying. I know notes are being taken and my note is being written while I'm interacting with the patient. Freed listens, transcribes, and writes instant clinical notes for you in your style. It can be used across all specialties for in-office as well as virtual visits, and it works in multiple languages. It's written in your style and ready the moment the visit is over. All you have to do is copy it into your EHR. Freed is HIPAA compliant and only takes seconds to learn. Over 15,000 clinicians, including doctors, APPs, and therapists, have used Freed to save up to 2 hours every day and free themselves from documentation. Just imagine the great feeling of coming home without any notes hanging over your head. Get back to doing what you love and let Freed do the rest. Start your free trial today, no credit card needed. Use the code CURB50 to get $50 off your first month when you subscribe. So visit getfreed.ai and use the code CURB50. This episode is brought to you by Figs. Look, listeners, I'm wearing scrubs 5 days a week right now, and it's always Figs because I love them. They look good. They're comfortable. I love the colors. They just look better than all the other scrubs out there. And here at Curbsiders, we're always talking about the latest medical breakthroughs. And Figs, they are a major advancement in medical scrubs. The ones I used to wear, not comfortable. They didn't fit right. They didn't have the right amount of pockets. And 5 years ago, I started wearing Figs, and I remember thinking, hey, these look good, and I like them, and this is all I'm going to wear from now on. Figs is made for all of us in healthcare. They're lightweight, breathable, antimicrobial, and oh, they have tons of pockets for your stethoscope, your pager, your parking ticket that you forgot to validate, all of it. Like I said, I now have 5 pairs, and I don't wear anything else. If I'm in scrubs, I'm in Figs. And with the holidays right around the corner, it's a perfect time to treat yourself to fresh looks for the new year, which is great because Figs just dropped a ton of new limited edition colors and styles for the holiday season. And if you want to check them out, Figs is offering 15% off your first purchase at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX. So what are we telling patients and their families? Like, it's, you know, Suzanne has seen them. We're trying to get together a discharge plan. Allison, how do you talk to a patient or family about this?
Yeah. So I think a lot of patients assume that with aging, falls are normal and expected. And we know that about half of falls are not reported to physicians. So patients fall and they don't tell their doctor that they fell because they're, you know, they think it's normal or they think that it's going to lead to a loss of their independence. So we want to, tell patients that there are things that we can do to prevent falls. Once we've identified the risk factors, I think this is a great place to start a conversation with patients and just go over what you found in that multifactorial risk assessment and then talk about what you're going to recommend for each of the things that you have found. So for Faye's example, some of the things that I think that we've identified here are the bradycardia, several medications, her dementia, her arthritis, her diabetes maybe being a little bit more tightly controlled than we need, and then potentially home environment things. So each of those has potential interventions that we could recommend to the patient and her family.
Yeah. And we didn't really ask about exercise. She's preparing meals. If I don't want to jump to conclusions, but a lot of the time that is like just kind of doing any light housework or meal prep is like the only exercise some people are getting at that age. So that's, I do think that's something we should, we can ask about, we should be assessing. I'm sorry if I missed this. Did you mention the donepezil? You know, I know we've talked about this with Eric Wadero, like way back when, Paul, that donepezil, he mentioned a case of someone getting a pacemaker because they were on donepezil and it was causing bradycardia. So that's one that I always like kind of point out. But this patient's also on metoprolol as well. So you probably go there first. But
yeah, I mean, actually, yeah, definitely. So I think that's like when I was talking about the medications and the bradycardia with this case, like when I look at her medication list, that's the thing that stuck out to me first is the metoprolol and the donepezil. Could back off on the metoprolol depending on why she's on it. Though we also know that donepezil isn't always that effective, can have some side effects. So you could also potentially think about deprescribing that if you're concerned that it's not really helping and that might be contributing to the bradycardia. So I think there's lots of potentials for adjusting her medications. I'd probably start with either the donepezil or the metoprolol, given the bradycardia that you identified in the hospital.
Yeah.
So Allison, I think even back when Matt and I were in training back in the days of therapeutic leeches and stuff, and we were using warfarin a lot, there was always these sort of agonal conversations anytime any patient had a fall, like whether to continue the warfarin and what to do about that. And even back then, I think the conversation was it's probably safer for most folks to be on the warfarin than not. But I guess this is me sort of leading into what is the conversation around continued anticoagulation look like for someone who's had a fall? And yeah, I guess how important is this head strike play into it or not? And sort of what's that look like for you and what factors do you think about?
Yeah, I think it's a very nuanced conversation and obviously a complicated decision for patients. That it's normally not one that I'm trying to have in the hospital with someone that don't know. Of course, you can calculate the Hasbled score, you can calculate their CHADS-VASc score and kind of weigh out the numbers. But I really don't think the numbers are that useful in making that kind of decision. It's a lot more nuanced. You want to understand the patient's overall trajectory, their goals, what their tolerance for different risks are. And I just don't think we do that well in the inpatient setting. So usually in the hospital, unless there's like some immediate contraindication for the anticoagulation, I'm continuing it, but you know, connecting with the patient's PCP to let them know that there was a fall to make sure that they have good follow-up.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go. It's hard even starting anticoagulation, like if you diagnose someone with new atrial fibrillation, like a lot of the times the patients want to talk to somebody like their cardiologist or they want to talk to their primary care, someone that they know and trust that is going to follow them long term. That's always tricky. So, and we could, of course, spend a lot of time on that, but we'll move on. So the next part of the case, the PT evaluation reveals that currently Faye requires minimal assistance, 25% for bed mobility transfers and ambulation with a rollator walker going 16 feet, and her mobility is limited by aggravation of osteoarthritis, neuropathy, fear of falling. So Suzanne recommends discharge to inpatient skilled therapy services at a skilled nursing facility to maximize safe functional mobility before return home. And upon return home, she'll likely need physical therapy, occupational therapy for home safety, and you know, trying to get her back to community mobility. Suzanne, can you talk about like your part in this with the decision? Like, does somebody need to go to a skilled nursing facility? Sometimes people call those subacute rehab, although I don't know if that's the wrong terminology or not. But can you talk a little bit about what goes into your decision making there? Because that's always been a little bit of a black box to me.
Sure. The SNF versus subacute rehab, a lot of people just call it SNF. So just for the sake of being, unclear as possible, I'm going to just say SNF. Essentially, it's in my documentation at where I work, when we write it in the note, we write less than 3 hours of inpatient skilled therapy. And that would be compared to more than 3 hours of inpatient skilled therapy, which would be an acute level of rehab. What I'm looking at is this person requires physical assistance in order to move safely. Once you move from doing an activity independently or with supervision to a minimal assistance, that's, requiring physical assistance. Her son works during the day. she is home alone during the day. He's available by phone, but you know, if she falls and he's not there, it's not the best situation for her to return home when she requires physical assistance. What the stair glide in the house tells me is that she's already experiencing some difficulty with mobility. So that kind of gives me a little like, oh, she's already having trouble on the steps. I know that she has steps to get into the house. I want to make sure that we're setting her up for success. And she's going to have to go to doctor's appointments when she gets home from all of this. There's always follow-up appointments, and there's going to be those 5 steps to get in and out of that house. And I want to make sure that she's going to be able to get to those appointments. Right now, she's not going to be able to. I want to get her to a rehab where she's going to be able to get an hour of physical therapy, an hour of occupational therapy. I don't think that she has any swallowing needs, but speech therapy in a rehab setting doesn't just focus on swallowing, but also on cognition. So they'll be able to also see her if they, on evaluation, find that that's what she needs.
Okay. Allison, this comes up all the time. Like the patient, so Suzanne sees the patient requires assistance, physical assistance. So we're recommending a skilled nursing facility, but the patient doesn't want to do that, wants to go home. How do you handle that situation?
Yeah, this comes up all the time. I'm sure a lot of listeners can relate as well. It's always a recommendation to the patient, right? It's always, we have to always go back to like the fifth M matters most. Like, what is the patient's goals? And they need to be factored into this. So yes, it's the recommendation. We can explain why we're making that recommendation, but we really need to listen to the patient, like why maybe they disagree. And then think about ways that we can make the patient as safe as possible to go home if that's their preference. And there are things that we can do in the home to help make that safer as well.
So Faye, she completes her hospital course. She is back home. She is now established as part of your primary care panel. We'll say collective you. We are all one doctor in this case. We're primary care doctors. She presents to the office. She's accompanied by her son. She's using her rolling walker in the office with a steady gait, which is wonderful news. So I guess now that the acute stuff is over with and she sort of declared herself, and now we're sort of in, I guess, harm reduction, what can we do in the outpatient setting to kind of maximize her chances of staying out of the hospital and prevent recurrent falls? So where would you start? And then we can sort of get into specific details. I'm sure Matt has tons of questions about diet and exercise.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, the other things that we can do to prevent falls that have a good evidence base, we talked about the multifactorial risk factor assessment. Maybe they didn't address all of the risk factors in the hospital. So maybe the PCP would then look at that discharge summary and address, you know, the next thing on the list. But the other big one is exercise. We know that exercise, specifically balance and strength training, has been shown to reduce the risk of falls. And we recommend exercise for all patients. So patients at low risk of falling and patients at high risk of falling, they all benefit from strength and balance training. And that can look very different depending on your patient. And we can talk about different programs or ways that you would recommend that.
Yeah. Are there any specific programs just to name or that you think work or that shine as opposed to others?
So Suzanne's laughing. So Tai Chi is one specific exercise program that's been shown to be beneficial. And Suzanne has experience in that. I don't know if you want to share.
I'm certified as a Tai Chi instructor for arthritis and falls prevention. So the focus is on movement, but also being conscious of how you move and where your body is in space when you're weight shifting and doing some of some complex movements and, you know, incorporating all of those things into it. So it's got a mind and body component. So it really is. It's something that you can also adjust. So we can do it from starting in a chair position. If somebody can't tolerate standing, we can then have them stand with a walker and minimize some of the stepping movements that might be more difficult and focus on arms and tolerating the standing and then getting to being able to move from hopefully needing a walker to a cane to hopefully nothing. Well, the perception is that once somebody gets an assistive device, that they won't, that they'll always have that assistive device forever. And that's not necessarily true. The safest gait pattern is a normal step through gait pattern. And you would want to get back to that as much as possible. For some people, it's not. But there are a lot of people that they don't need to be with an assistive device forever. And if we can get them to a point where they can perform their activities around the house and into the community without an assistive device, that really would be optimal.
I love that point. I think that's patients need to hear that, you know, if it's true for them, like if there's somebody that does have that rehab potential, I think it would be really helpful for people to hear that, like that you know, this is not a permanent thing. I also love that you're a Tai Chi instructor. That's badass. And also, does this occur in a park? Because every time I see Tai Chi done in a movie, it's always just like the happiest people in a park doing Tai Chi.
It does happen in parks a lot. The more that you get into more of the Eastern type medicine and therapies like Tai Chi, there is a component to, you know, being in a park and grounding yourself.
Right.
But okay. whatever space you can do it in, there are videos of me online that I have some friends and they've gotten their family members and they'll do it with their family member.
Oh, that's great.
To do it. Yeah.
Going along with that, I think sometimes people wonder about like practically, like it's one thing to say like do more exercise or go do Tai Chi, but like how do we actually physically counsel patients? And like we need some sort of plan for how we're going to have patients do this exercise that we're recommending. So I like to think about, you know, when I'm assessing the person for their risk of falls, is this someone who needs to be at home or can they be out in a public setting, or is it an individual or a group or supervised or unsupervised? So those are kind of some of the ways that you might frame different exercise programs. And then depending on how independent the person is and how what you deem their fall risk to be, you might make a recommendation. Anything from, you know, Faye, who's just getting out of the hospital, or, you know, she's probably going to be doing something at home supervised by a physical therapist. But maybe once she's progressed, she could go to outpatient physical therapy, or she could go to a exercise class at a senior center, or even just do a video online. So it's just, there's lots of different options, but I think it's helpful for patients if you recommend specifically like some type of program.
Yeah. And I was looking up some of the specifics about strength training programs for this. And they were like 2 to 3 sessions a week. They were using like 50-80% of their one repetition maximum and doing like 6 to 12 repetitions, it sounds like, per set. And I think it was like 50 hours total of training time that people needed to prevent falls. So it's over the course of like 12 weeks or something like that they're doing all this exercise. But I think we underestimate, like at my job, I'm seeing a lot of people exercise that, like, I think people are capable of a lot more than we give them credit for. And I think that like this generation of people that are middle-aged now are doing a lot more like exercise strength training. And it's going to be interesting to see what they're like when they're in their 70s, 80s, 90s, when they have this, like, you know, they're very experienced like with strength training. And they're experimenting with all these other things, Tai Chi, and it'll be interesting.
Yeah, again, there's strong evidence for exercise for fall prevention for people who have never fallen and are at low fall risk, and then also for people who have had major falls. So a lot of people can benefit from that.
Yeah. And do you talk to people about like other intervention, like a diet, protein intake, things like that for older adults that are just eating, you know, a very simple like diet, and then they're having frailty? Like, I don't know how much of that comes into it. I was trying to look up the evidence for this, and it's mostly evidence around sarcopenia, not necessarily like directly tying it to falls.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of that yet for falls.
But I did want to ask, Allison, where are we with vitamin D in falls now? I know, again, back when I was in training, vitamin D was going to cure everything. It was going to prevent pneumonia and reduce the risk of cancer, and no one would ever fall again. But is that still the case, or has that evolved in terms of how we think about vitamin D for older folks?
Yeah, that's changed. We don't think that vitamin D in and of itself prevents falls. There is maybe some thought that older adults that have low vitamin D levels, like that supplementing that might be helpful. But for all comers, like we don't just supplement vitamin D for fall prevention. And then, you know, maybe if someone has a low vitamin D, though, even that can be debated on like what is an optimal level. But, you know, generally I would supplement someone who is low, but not just for fall prevention.
So the last part of the falls thing, so we talked about the multifactorial, what is this, MFRFA, multifactorial risk factor assessment. Yes,
I like it. I think you're on to something.
Yes. Okay. So the MFRFA, Paul. We talked about that. We talked about exercise. Vitamin D doesn't work. Tai Chi is great. And what about home modifications? What's the evidence there?
Yeah, so that's the third arm of fall prevention. So home modifications, also in meta-analyses, about 23% fall risk, relative risk reduction for falls. They can include a variety of things. So, you know, when I think about home modifications, again, I am a house call home-based primary care provider, so I can see patients in their homes. But if you don't have that ability, occupational therapists perform home safety evaluations. I've ordered those a lot for patients that I see in the hospital. When they go home, an occupational therapist comes out, does an evaluation, and maybe makes recommendations that could help the person in their home. Another great resource for this is CDC STEADI, STEADI, which is their fall prevention website. There's a really good one-page kind of home safety checklist that I've printed off and given to patients before to take home and kind of look at their own home environment and make potential modifications. And then from there, like if you have an occupational therapist that's going to come out, they might recommend certain DME, which has been shown to be helpful. Things like grab bars, shower chairs. Maybe Suzanne might have more to say about that. But, you know, there's equipment that people have in their home. For example, Faye had the stair glide, which is one example of a home modification that might be helpful for people.
I can add a little bit about home modifications. In the kitchen, one of the things that we do for somebody like Faye, who has arthritis in her knees, is to kind of prevent her from having to go into really low cabinets. So the things that she uses, we're going to put at the easiest level for her to get to. And the things that she uses the least are going to be on the low and the very high shelves. It seems like something that's so simple and easy, but people have had a system to their kitchen organization for years, and they don't always want to change it. But when you kind of talk them through it and you do it, you come back a week later and they are thrilled. They're thrilled. My knees it's don't so bother smart. Me as much. My back doesn't bother me. It's so much easier to do all of this cooking if I sit down and chop while I'm sitting. That kind of
That's
stuff.
Good. I also, my other favorite tip you gave was where you were like, I tell them to push the plates down to the counter. So they just have to make a simple turn and put the plates on the table, like not carry it 10 feet. Like that kind of stuff is, it's like low hanging fruit, but you know, people might not think of it because Paul and I are thinking about like medication interactions and the, you know, polypharmacy, not necessarily thinking about these practical, very practical things that people can do physically. So that's great.
Yeah, Matt, that's why we're an interdisciplinary team. Everybody plays a part. And I really do believe that.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Well, I think we are at the end of the interview. Usually at this point, we will do take-home points. So Allison, we'll go to you first. Did you have like one or two take-home points you wanted the audience to remember about this discussion?
Yeah, I think we owe it to our patients to think past mechanical falls and really try to get at all the different factors that could contribute to falls, because the identification and treatment is multifactorial. So we want to really dig into causes of falls so that we can help our patients prevent future falls.
And Suzanne, how about you? One or two take-home points?
I think that the interdisciplinary team is so important in preventing falls. My perspective is different than my colleagues, the occupational therapists. We could be in the same room looking at the same patient and see different things and have different takeaways. And that's really a great thing because I'd like to have somebody else's point of view. And then I go to interdisciplinary rounds and we discuss it and we talk with case management and social work and the nurse that's been taking care of them that day. And it really helps the whole plan come together. We want to really set somebody up for success.
We can't thank the both of you enough for spending all this time with us hanging out on air. And also like to say, Suzanne, Paul and I are going to come to whatever your next Tai Chi class is.
Awesome.
Well, the point I was going to make is earlier is I cannot think of a like almost zero harm intervention that has evidence for depression, for low back pain, for fall prevention. Like it's recommended by every guideline. I think I've got a patient who does Tai Chi and I just don't even think to recommend it. So it seems like such an underutilized resource. I may start hunting down videos to actually refer them to just because it seems like it's great for everything, but I just don't think of it probably enough. This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
I don't know, somehow the breaking up of those syllables really made it even more upsetting. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, recapping the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and we want your feedback, so email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. Reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. A special thanks to our writers and producers for this episode, Rachel Miller and Abby Schmucker. Leah Witt, I believe, also had something to do with this. And to our whole Curbsiders team, our technical production is done by the team at Podpace. Elizabeth Proto does our social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Manchu moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed our theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And as always, our main Dr. Paul Nelson Williams, thank you and goodbye.